The basic point of yesterday's presentation and discussion was that one of the difficulties we have in dealing with an issue like economic justice is that we all come with certain preconceived notions, and we tend to something like economics that we're afraid of, that it's a discipline that is left to the experts. We tend to relate to that in terms of very simple kinds of cliches, and that one of the things I think we need to do is to open ourselves to new ways of looking at things. Now, what I want to do today is sort of building on that a little bit, but I want to deal with a preconception that probably most of us have about what ethics is. Now, I went to college and seminary in the 1960s, and the ethics book that excited us was a book by Joseph Fletcher called Situation Ethics. For those of us who came up in very conservative, legalistic churches, that was a very liberating kind of experience to read Fletcher and to find out that all of these rules, you know, you don't smoke, you don't drink, you don't play marbles for keeps, gambling, maybe we could loosen up on those a little bit. Fletcher was followed by a number of sort of disciples and critics, but in the 60s and 70s, ethics became what has been come to be called ethics of decision. In other words, ethics has to do with certain dilemmas, moral dilemmas, or moral quandaries, about which you have to make certain decisions. And so, Fletcher's book was full of these moral quandaries. Now, this kind of approach to ethics had a powerful appeal to professors and students and church groups because it was so easy to get a discussion going. I remember one of his little quandaries had to do with the apparently true story of an American mother on the frontier who was attacked by Indians. And she had three children, and she took them and hid, and the youngest child was an infant, and the baby started crying. And the mother choked the baby and saved herself and the other two children because the Indians didn't find them. And so, you know, the moral quandary is obvious. Should the mother have taken the life of the youngest child in order to save herself and the other two? And there was at least that there was one Baptist church in Kentucky that actually split over that issue on the the problem with that approach to ethics is that ethics has to do with specific episodes in the life of a Christian. You know, you come to you get up in the morning and you simply go about living a fairly normal day. And you don't, ethics doesn't enter in until you reach some kind of dilemma that you don't know what to do with. Now, there are certain problems with this, because I think this is a very unbiblical notion of ethics, if that is all ethics is. Now, I don't want to say that ethics doesn't have anything to do with making decisions, that it doesn't have anything to do with these kind of moral dilemmas or quandaries. It certainly does. But there is a more basic level of ethics that scholars have begun, ethicists have begun to talk about, particularly over the last 10 to 15 years. And that is what has come to be called the ethics of character. Now, I want to kind of handle this session in two stages. First, I want to use two, maybe three scriptural texts, if we have time, to try to make the point that ethics, Christian ethics, is not simply the application of one's faith. But I want to try to make the claim that ethics is the substance of faith. Or another way of putting it is, ethics is not something that is simply prepared for in what we call worship, but that ethics itself is worship. Now, I want to sort of look at two scripture passages, and you're probably going to wonder, why in the world did he choose these? One is Exodus 20, 4 through 6. Now, this is the second commandment. Anybody know what the second commandment is? What's the second commandment? No graven images. All right, let's see. I think the Lutherans now have a different way of enumerating them than, because Luther breaks that covetousness one into two parts, and then he combines the first, doesn't he, Mark?
That's right.
Yeah. But we Baptists do it the right way. Okay, well, anyway, this it doesn't matter whether it's first or second or whatever, but you shall not make for yourself a graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children of the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. Now, I want to focus here on the, the basic commandment, you shall not make for yourself a graven image or any likeness of anything. Now, I had a friend in seminary who always was saying, and I'm so grateful for the second commandment because that's one of them I can keep. I mean, he was not tempted to bow down to graven images. Images carved out of stone or bronze or wood. What do you make of that?
A limited idea of graven images.
A limited idea of graven images, okay. What's the appeal of graven images? That's a very, very good suggestion that the problem for any religion is how does one make the deity accessible? And vision is such a powerful sense that if we can see something, that seems to be more real. The comment you make about the photograph is interesting because last year I was going on a trip overseas and gone for 6 weeks, and my wife and children were at home. And I carried with me a photograph of all three. And it was incredible how those photographs were helpful. I mean, I didn't forget what they looked like, I don't think, but just to be able to see the picture. Now, sometimes we don't give, I think, some of these ancient religions enough credit. Because if you read the literature of some of these ancient religions, they did not identify the statue, the graven image, with the reality of God. this was something that sort of pointed to God. It was a way, a tangible way of trying to relate to God. Now, why is it that the Hebrews break so decisively with that tradition? Yeah, just about all in the ancient Near East. And so far as we can tell, the ancient Hebrews made a pretty decisive break with that. In other words, Moses said, now we want to be different it could have to do with the Hebrew experience of God, that the Hebrew understanding of God seemed to kind of heighten the distance between human beings and God. I mean, you had a strong move here toward transcendence and otherness, that the image can give one the illusion perhaps of control. And now that would relate fairly specifically to the third commandment, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, which for us has been reduced to kind of verbal profanity, using God's name in conjunction with them. But Walter Harrelson suggests that the real thrust of the third commandment, for example, is you shall not use religion for selfish ends. That's really what the thrust of that commandment is. That, you know, we want a religion where we can kind of control and manipulate God to work in our interest. And in fact, the very words God damn is sort of calling upon God to destroy, in a way. Although, I mean, for us, it's just kind of, we use it flippantly when we hit our thumb with a hammer or something. But there's another clue here that I didn't pick up until I read a book a couple years ago by Walter Harrelson, professor of Old Testament at Vanderbilt, called The Ten Commandments and Human Rights. And Harrelson points out that this commandment has a positive side to it that we've missed. If you go back to Genesis 1:26, who is it that is created in the image of God? Human beings. And so Harrelson argues that the Hebrew prohibition against images has the flip side, that it is only human beings, when they are faithful to the God of the covenant, that can represent God in the world. Now, if Harrelson's right, and I and most of the reviews of that book have agreed with Harrelson on that point, then that means that that worship cannot be confined simply to sacred times, sacred places, but one represents God in the kind of life one lives. And when Paul Hansen of Harvard Divinity School is going to be here next week, and he's just written a mammoth book on the concept of people in the Bible. And of course, what we're dealing with here is not simply commandments addressed to individuals, but to a whole group, a community. It's almost as if Israel is sort of God's pilot project, that God chooses a community, a people, to represent God in the world. And so everything Israel does is related to the covenant. So you really can't say that ethics is a kind of secondary reflection on the faith. In other words, the kind of life one lives is indeed the substance of faith. Let's turn to the New Testament. In the Gospel of Mark, haven't gotten to this in the morning Bible study yet, but the story of Jesus cleansing the temple in Mark 11, 15 through 19. And they came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple and began to drive out those who sold and those who bought in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons. And he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. And he taught and said to them, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations,' but you have made it a den of robbers?" And the chief priests and the scribes heard it and sought a way to destroy him, for they feared him, because all the multitude was astonished at his teaching. And when evening came, they went out of the city. Why did Jesus throw the merchants and money changers out of the temple? If we can find the answer to that, I think we've got a good clue to something. Why did Jesus throw them out?
Were they exploiting the poor?
Okay, exploiting the poor. First of all, maybe we need to ask a prior question. Why were they in there to start with? Why were the merchants and money changers in the temple to start with?
Well, to provide the animals that you needed for worship. But they were, like you said, okay, the first time, they were using religion to enrich themselves.
Okay, how were they doing that?
Because they were making probably an exorbitant profit on selling the
okay
stuff so that other people could have the convenience of coming to the temple and purchasing
it there. Okay, so you're saying then that the merchants and the money changers are selling the animals at inflated prices, and they are not giving a good exchange rate on the money exchange.
I suppose it's a possibility.
Okay. That's a fairly typical kind of answer. As Mark Edwards pointed out last night in his talk about Judaism, there were more Jews living outside of Palestine in the first century than there were in Palestine. And when they made pilgrimages to Jerusalem and wanted to offer a sacrifice, you know, you couldn't carry a lamb or a pigeon on a 1,000-mile journey. So it was a convenience to buy after you got there. And it was also the temple tax could be paid only in certain kinds of coins, and so that was part of the reason for the exchange. But now, what's the clue? You say that they're using religion here for selfish ends. What's the clue to that that you find?
Well, Jesus called them thieves and robbers.
Okay. And he says, "You've made it a den of thieves." Okay. Now, is Jesus referring in that statement to the merchants and the money changers? What's a den of thieves? What's the den?
Where they hide out.
Where they hide out. Okay. It was a book by Paul Ochtemeyer that sort of clued me into this. A den is not where the crime is committed, but it's where the people hide out after the crime. See, we wanted to sort of turn the merchants and the money changers into the thieves, but it may be that somebody else is the thief. I mean, the temple is the den. And so it's not just the merchants and money changers that are using religion for selfish ends, but it's everybody. There's a little quote. There's another clue here. Jesus says, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations,' but you have made it a den of robbers?" You know where that comes from? It comes from Jeremiah's temple sermon in Jeremiah 7. And what Jeremiah is doing in that sermon in Jeremiah 7 is he's saying, thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your doing, and I will let you dwell in this place. Do not trust in these deceptive words. This is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. Behold, you trust in deceptive words to no avail. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, burn incense to Baal, and go after other gods that you have not known? And then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered. Now, Jesus is kind of linking his action here to what's going on in Jeremiah. What's the problem with the temple?
Cheap grace.
Cheap grace. In other words, the people, what they're doing on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday doesn't have any bearing on what's going on the Sabbath. They're kind of using religion for cheap grace. That's a good way to put it. Right here.
Can you relate that to the selling of indulgences?
To the selling of indulgences?
Have you spread it that far?
I think there's certainly a tie to that. I mean, where you, the Pope tries to manipulate the people to so he can raise money to build St. Peter's. Yeah. Mark?
But then why does he take it out on the money changers and the pigeon sellers? I mean, it seemed more appropriate to take it out on some other group.
Well, this was... this would be a way, I guess, of kind of disrupting the means of carrying out that worship. Now, there's a problem here, I think, of whether this is Mark's interpretation of what happened, and whether this is Jesus' intention. For example, in the Gospel of Luke, the thrust of this story seems to be in a little different direction than in the Gospel of Mark. Let me put one more clue here. One of the unique things that Mark does with this passage is that it is sandwiched in between the story of Jesus cursing the fig tree. And Mark is the only gospel that does that. So, for example, in verses 12 to 14, you have sort of the beginning of that story. On the following day, when they came from Bethany, he was hungry. And seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to see if he could find anything on it. When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. And he said to it, may no one ever eat fruit from you again. And his disciples heard it. And then you have the story of Jesus cleansing the temple. And then you pick up the little story of the fig tree again. As they passed by in the morning, they saw the fig tree withered away to its roots. And Peter remembered and said to him, Master, look, the fig tree which you cursed is withered. And Jesus answered them, have faith in God. And then follows a little monologue about faith and prayer. Now, could it be that this is a technique that Mark is using to try to draw an analogy between Jesus cursing the fig tree and his protest in the temple? And just as the fig tree is not bearing fruit, the temple is not bearing fruit. Now, it could well be, see, that this Mark is written either about 70, which is just after the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, or shortly thereafter. And, this may be Mark's way of suggesting that simply because the temple has been destroyed, our faith is not destroyed. Now that kind of theme seems to be more explicit in Luke and Acts, but at any rate, the point I want to see here right now is, I think, that that this little story of Jesus draws a link between the way we live day by day and what we call worship. And so, you know, any kind of thing that would tend to violate that. Ron, you had it.
Yeah, that seems to harken back to, I forget which Micah or Hosea were commented on, sick to death of your sacrifices, do justice.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and I think you may be referring there to Amos 5.
Yes.
The I despise, I hate your solemn assemblies. I hate, I despise your feasts, and I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and cereal offerings, I will not accept them. And the peace offerings of your fatted beast I will not look upon. Take away from me the noise of your songs. To the melody of your harps I will not listen. And then that verse that Martin Luther King was so fond of, but let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. And so the... in other words, one's relationship to God is an intensely and intrinsically moral relationship. I mean that. Now, let me. There was one other passage that I kind of wanted to deal with, and that's Romans 12, 1 and 2, but I think our time has slipped away. So let me kind of move from this to to kind of drawing out some implications for passage in Romans was kind of a transition point, but we can't do everything. So, I want to kind of carry this into the idea that that ethics, Christian ethics, has to do not simply with the manipulation of ideas about certain kind of moral decisions we face, but to a community that is defined by certain practices and certain a certain story, a narrative, and that provides a context in which we grow and develop into certain kinds of people. One of the problems with the way we usually think about ethics is that we often find ourselves in situations where we don't have the luxury of time to reflect. We simply have to act. And this requires, I think, a kind of a certain disposition, a certain kind of character. And let me kind of illustrate this with an experience of from my past. While I was a graduate student at Vanderbilt, I worked Saturdays in the Baptist bookstore in Nashville, Tennessee. One Saturday about noon, the store was bustling with customers, and in walked a young man of about 25. His clothes were tattered, he hadn't shaved in a few days, he was black. And he waited patiently in line at the cash register right next to mine. And the store was pretty crowded. This was right about lunchtime. And when he got to the cash register, he asked the lady there for something to eat. And she said, well, you know, this is a bookstore. We don't have anything to eat. Which wasn't true. because we had a very well-stocked employee's kitchen back. And then he said, well, could you give me some money to buy something to eat? And she said, well, we just can't give money away. And of course, by this time, you could hear a pin drop as all attention focused on this man. And the manager came out and sort of took him by the collar and escorted him out the door. Now, the sign over the entrance to all bad service with a Christian distinction. Now, during the time the man was standing there, you know, I had this real kind of existential crisis. I started thinking, you know, my lunch break starts in 30 minutes. I've got a sandwich that I could give to him, or I could take him to the McDonald's down the street and buy him a hamburger. But then I got to thinking, you know, see, I got to work all afternoon. I need to rest. And besides, Alabama and Tennessee are going to be playing on television. There was a little TV there in the back, and I can probably pick up the first half of that. And so I froze. And, you know, the man was ushered out. And I got back for my lunch break, and the sandwich was yucky, and the ball game was not interesting, and I kept thinking about that verse from Matthew, that I was hungry, and you gave me no food. Now, here I was confronted with a deficiency of character. Now, after I got home and reflected on this, I knew exactly what I should have done. But I didn't have the kind of virtues, the kind of disposition to respond appropriately in the moment without reflection. I've never been particularly fond of the passage in Galatians 5 where Paul contrasts the works of the flesh with the fruits of the Spirit. When I was a child, this was used by my Sunday school teachers to support a very narrow, moralistic view of the Christian life and an unbiblical dualism of the body and soul. Now, I don't question the sincerity of these teachers or the genuineness of their faith, but I do question their lack of balance in dealing with the two lists. Most attention was always focused on the works of the flesh, especially on those sins of the body like fornication, licentiousness, drunkenness, carousing, etc. And the Christian life became identified with a very narrow list of don'ts. I was pretty sure that Paul would not be much fun at a party. Now, careful reflection on the second list, the fruits of the Spirit, I think, explodes the idea that Paul views the Christian life primarily in terms of negative virtues. You know, this list is not the typical list of the narrow-minded Puritan: love, joy, peace, patience, etc. To use one of Reinhold Niebuhr's favorite phrases, these virtues are, in a sense, kind of impossible possibilities. Who possesses them? Who could possess them? Could it be that Paul is describing here what Christian character is about? This is the we could have taken the Beatitudes, I think. That's a kind of character sketch. Sally McFagg thinks so. She thinks that Paul is here dealing with the formation of character, and by character she means the studied and steady qualities of mind and spirit that develop slowly over the lifetime of Christian discipleship. Whatever else we may need to be followers of Jesus, we need character. Not any character, and not different characters at different times, but a character that is formed by the Christian community and the Christian story that can be counted on when the going gets rough. Character is the disposition in a person that is the person. a settled and dependable way of responding that defines a person. Thus, Paul's fruits of the Spirit are essentially virtues that point to a particular kind of disposition or a character, a transformation by the renewing of yourself. To quote McFagg again, these are qualities one either has developed prior to needing and practicing them, or one does not have them when one needs them. No one can work up patience or faithfulness or self-control or peace and love on the spur of the moment at the moment of crisis. One acts as one is. At the close of this little passage in Galatians 5, Paul tells us to walk by the Spirit. Not run or jump or take a chariot, but walk. Now, walking is an humble mode of journeying, a slow way, suggestive of some determination, discipline, and perseverance. Christians have long been called people of the way, those who walk in a certain direction. Those who walk in the way develop, as settled character, the virtues of the one whom they follow. He is the way. He is the one who did not simply do obedient, loving, faithful acts, but was himself obedient, loving, faithful, and good. Now, what I'm trying to get at with this and how I want this to relate to the sessions tomorrow and Thursday, although those will be pretty much self-contained, is that I think it's only from the from this kind of very basic sense of faith as a way of life, faith as a character defined by a community that is itself defined by a particular story. And for the Christian community, that story is essentially the story of Israel and Jesus and fear of the church. That it's only from that vantage point that we can look carefully and comprehensively at economic systems and economic reasoning. If we kind of fall back into the old way of thinking about ethics only in terms of making decisions about moral dilemmas, then we don't have much basis for a real social ethic. And ethics and economics usually turns into, in that case, a discussion of how a businessman ought to treat his employees or how much he should give to the church, and it really doesn't get to some of the more basic kinds of issues that I think questions about economic justice ought to raise. Okay, we've got about 10 or 15 minutes here. Let me see what kind of contributions and all you want to.
Going back to one of your first points about creating images, I'm a slow thinker. I've been thinking about that for quite a while. The Jewish people in Egypt were living in a society that worshipped many gods, Horus and the sun and so on. I wonder if they were prohibited from having any kinds of images of their own god, and were used to that kind of more abstract monotheism, just by being forced to be that way. Mm-hmm. So that when Moses says, "Thou shalt have no other graven image," this may be a continuation of what they're
practiced. Yeah, that's a very helpful suggestion, and I, I am not an Old Testament scholar, and I don't have the kind of factual basis to make to say that's right or wrong, but. It sounds very plausible.
Well, I'm not an Old Testament scholar either, so I will let my that.
We'll ask Paul Hansen that next week.
Could you say more about how to go about obtaining or attaining to this character and forming it in our lives, etc.?
Okay. This is a point of a lot of discussion right now. Some of the leading writers on this, the young man who has done more than any other to sort of bring this point back into discussion is a Stanley Hauerwas, who was Texas Presbyterian, went to Yale, and then taught for a number of years at Notre Dame. So you had a Presbyterian teaching at a Catholic seminary, and also on the faculty there was a Mennonite, John Howard Yoder. And so the confluence of the Catholic emphasis. See, I think one of the things that we Protestants have always been afraid of, the language of virtue, is because it was so closely associated with Thomas Aquinas in that Catholic tradition. Now, you know, getting directly to the question, but Hauerwas tries to do several things. He has a book, for example, called A Community of Character, and he wants to return to a kind of almost Anabaptist view of the church, that the church ought to be a visible communion of saints. In other words, that the church, the community itself, ought to be defined by the story. Another element of Hauerwas' thinking is that the more basic kind of religious language is not the language of doctrine, but it is the language of story. And he came under the influence of Hans Frey at Yale. While he was there. And so, you know, in terms of how one begins to realize this character in a practical way, is to try to return to the basic Christian story. And to think more explicitly about the kind of practices within that community that might shape these kinds of virtues. For example, just being here at Holden Village, I feel much freer about some things than I do at home. I mean, you know, when I stayed in a motel in Vancouver and all, we usually locked the door. I mean, here, the community is such that I'm simply free to leave my room open. And I think that encourages, that practice itself encourages a kind of trust that, you know, the kind of community I live in outside doesn't. Here at Holden, I feel perfectly free to put on anything I want to. Whereas in other contexts, there's a certain kind of a dress code. If not written, it's kind of implied. And so, you know, that kind of the Holden tradition provides a context for developing certain kinds of feelings about myself and others. So that might be an illustration of how, and I realize that that we're talking here in terms of ideals, and that that's why I referred to these virtues here as kind of impossible possibilities, because we're caught in the tension of being sinners on the one hand, and yet if grace is indeed a power that renews us and renews our communities, then you know, we ought to be moving in that direction.
I'd like to follow up on this gentleman's question with another question to you and see how you would maybe relate it to myself and all of us. And that is, in your first, say, 20 to 22 years of life, what do you think would have been a good way for Christian education in your home, the church, so that you would have been provided with this character that we can call epics, but your character, so that you could have, say, responded, not necessarily just to that one situation, but responded in a Christian community way, where you are?
I grew up in the 1950s when segregation was still sort of the norm. And my parents gave us some, we were never allowed, for example, to belittle a black person. My parents were different in that kind of way. But I think, for example, if my parents or the church had recognized that Christian faith ought to have something to do with the way white people relate to black people, that you know, that would have shaped me in a certain way that took me a lot longer to overcome later on. I mean, you simply grow up thinking that the maid is always black, and when we eat lunch at the house, she waits and eats in the kitchen later. And so you kind of internalize these things, and it takes a long time to overcome that. So that's a you know, maybe one specific kind of.
Well, let's relate it a little bit more generally, and looking at that group of so-called do's and don'ts of Galatians 5, and I agree with you thoroughly that the emphasis seems to be put on the negatives, and a lot of people that come out of the more conservative background where those are emphasized as taboos, miss the whole positive area, which is probably equally, if not more important, and more emphasis on that would be great. In shaping a Christian character from early years, which you could act upon and become, well, as you grow up, and then are growing. I don't think, like maybe Ryan will be for, that it's impossible to achieve a joy or a patience. As a character, sure, you may explode at a particular point. Hopefully, one explosion among 100 different episodes, and the rest of them you've been patient, shouldn't label you as an explosive character. Your basic character is that you are patient.
Harvost, I mean, at some point, talks about the practicing virtue. And he draws the parallels between, I mean, the fact that if one wants to be a musician, one puts in a lot of practice. And so that a virtue ought to be thought of as something like a skill. And, you know, we can, there can be little spiritual disciplines, little spiritual exercises that, now, you know, the danger we, the problem we Protestants have is that this is easily transmuted into a kind of works theology. And how do you, you know, keep the emphasis on salvation by grace, and at the same time allow for a kind of discipline that will indeed shape one? I think we've got a lot to learn from the Catholics here. But it's a tricky game. But if we, I mean, we recognize the need for practice in athletics, in music, in writing, in speaking, and things like this. Why not in the practice of virtue? And so what the church needs to do is to experiment with kinds of disciplines that can move not only children but adults.
That's why we're here.
Yeah, exactly. Look, thanks a lot.